Chapter 34. A sudden blush rose to young Mrs. Archer's face. It surprised her husband as much as the other guests about the table. "H. Ellen," she murmured, much in the same accusing and yet deprecating tone in which her parents might have said. H. the Blenkers. It was the note which the family had taken to sounding on the mention of the Countess Olenska's name, since as he had surprised and inconvenienced them by remaining obdurate to her husband's advances. But on May's lips it gave food for thought, and Archer looked at her with a sense of strangeness that sometimes came over him when she was most in the tone of her environment. His mother, with less than her usual sensitiveness to atmosphere, still insisted. I've always thought that people like the Countess Olenska, who have lived in aristocratic societies, ought to help us to keep up our social distinctions, instead of ignoring them. May's blush remained permanently vivid. It seemed to have a significance beyond that implied by the recognition of Madame Olenska's social bad faith. "I've no doubt we all seem alike to foreigners," said Miss Jackson tartly. "I don't think Ellen cares for society, but nobody knows exactly what she does care for," May continued, as if as he had been groping for something noncommittal. "Ah, well," Mrs. Archer sighed again. Everybody knew that the Countess Olenska was no longer in the good graces of her family. Even her devoted champion, old Mrs. Manson Mingott, had been unable to defend her refusal to return to her husband. The Mingotts had not proclaimed their disapproval aloud. Their sense of solidarity was too strong. They had simply, as Mrs. Willand said, let poor Ellen find her own level, and that, mortifyingly and incomprehensibly, was in the dim depths where the Blenkers prevailed, and Eopold, who wrote, celebrated their untidy rites. It was incredible, but it was a fact, that Ellen, in spite of all her opportunities and her privileges, had become simply a Bohemian. The fact enforced the contention that as he had made a fatal mistake in not returning to Count Olenski. After all, a young woman's place was under her husband's roof, especially when as he had left it in circumstances that... If one had cared to look into them... Madame Olenska is a great favorite with the gentleman, said Miss Sophie, with her air of wishing to put forth something conciliatory when she knew that she was planting a dart. Ah, that's the danger that a young woman like Madame Olenska is always exposed to, Mrs. Archer mournfully agreed, and the ladies, on this conclusion, gathered up their trains to seek the castle globes of the drawing room, while Archer and Mr. Sillerton Jackson withdrew to the Gothic library. Once established before the grate, and consoling himself for the inadequacy of the dinner by the perfection of his cigar, Mr. Jackson became portentous and communicable. "If the Beaufort smash comes," he announced, "there are going to be disclosures." Archer raised his head quickly. He could never hear the name without the sharp vision of Beaufort's heavy figure, opulently furred and shod, advancing through the snow at Skuytercliff. "There's bound to be," Mr. Jackson continued, "the nastiest kind of a cleaning up. He hasn't spent all his money on Regina." "Oh, well, that's discounted, isn't it? My belief is he'll pull out yet," said the young man, wanting to change the subject. "Perhaps, perhaps. I know he was to see some of the influential people today." "Of course," Mr. Jackson reluctantly conceded, "it's to be hoped they can tide him over this time anyhow. I shouldn't like to think of poor Regina spending the rest of her life in some shabby foreign watering place for bankrupts." Archer said nothing. It seemed to him so natural, however tragic, that money ill-gotten should be cruelly expiated, that his mind, hardly lingering over Mrs. Beaufort's doom, wandered back to closer questions. What was the meaning of May's blush, when the Countess Olenska had been mentioned? 4 months had passed since the midsummer day that he and Madame Olenska had spent together, and since then he had not seen her. He knew that as he had returned to Washington, to the little house which she and Medora Manson had taken there, He had written to her once a few words, asking when they were to meet again, and this he had even more briefly replied, "Not yet." Since then there had been no farther communication between them, and he had built up within himself a kind of sanctuary in which he throned among his secret thoughts and longings. Little by little it became the scene of his real life, of his only rational activities. Thither he brought the books he read, the ideas and feelings which nourished him, his judgments and his visions. Outside it, in the scene of his actual life, he moved with a growing sense of unreality and insufficiency, blundering against familiar prejudices and traditional points of view as an absent-minded man goes on bumping into the furniture of his own room. Absent, that was what he was. So absent from everything most densely real, and near to those about him, that it sometimes startled him to find they still imagined he was there. He became aware that Mr. Jackson was clearing his throat preparatory to farther revelations. "I don't know, of course, how far your wife's family are aware of what people say about, well, about Madame Olenska's refusal to accept her husband's latest offer." Archer was silent, and Mr. Jackson obliquely continued, "It's a pity, it's certainly a pity that she refused it."
"A pity? In God's name, why?"
Mr. Jackson looked down his leg to the unwrinkled sock that joined it to a glossy pump. "Well, to put it on the lowest ground, what's she going to live on now?" "Now, if Beaufort," Archer sprang up, his fist banging down on the black walnut edge of the writing table. The wells of the brass double inkstand danced in their sockets.
"What the devil do you mean, sir?"
Mr. Jackson, shifting himself slightly in his chair, turned a tranquil gaze on the young man's burning face. "Well, I have it on pretty good authority, in fact, on old Catherine's herself, that the family reduced Countess Olenska's allowance considerably when she definitely refused to go back to her husband, and as, by this refusal, she also forfeits the money settled on her when she married, which Olenska was ready to make over to her if she returned."
"Why, what the devil do you mean, my dear boy, by asking me what I mean?"
Mr. Jackson good-humoredly retorted. Archer moved toward the mantelpiece and bent over to knock his ashes into the grate.
"I don't know anything of Madame Olenska's private affairs, but I don't need to be certain that what you insinuate..."
"Oh, I don't. It's Lefferts, for one," Mr. Jackson interposed. "Lefferts who made love to her and got snubbed for it." Archer broke out contemptuously.
"Ah, did he?"
snapped the other, as if this were exactly the fact he had been laying a trap for. He still sat sideways from the fire, so that his hard old gaze held Archer's face, as if in a spring of steel.
"Well, well, it's a pity she didn't go back before Beaufort's cropper," he repeated.
"If she goes now, and if he fails, it will only confirm the general impression, which isn't by any means peculiar to Lefferts, by the way."
"Oh, she won't go back now. Less than ever."
Archer had no sooner said it than he had once more the feeling that it was exactly what Mr. Jackson had been waiting for. The old gentleman considered him attentively.
"That's your opinion, eh?
Well, no doubt you know. But everybody will tell you that the few pennies Medora Manson has left are all in Beaufort's hands, and how the two women are to keep their heads above water unless he does, I can't imagine. Of course, Madame Olenska may still soften old Catherine, who's been the most inexorably opposed to her staying, and old Catherine could make her any allowance she chooses. But we all know that she hates parting with good money, and the rest of the family have no particular interest in keeping Madame Olenska here." Archer was burning with unavailing wrath. He was exactly in the state when a man is sure to do something stupid, knowing all the while that he is doing it. He saw that Mr. Jackson had been instantly struck by the fact that Madame Olenska's differences with her grandmother and her other relations were not known to him, and that the old gentleman had drawn his own conclusions as to the reasons for Archer's exclusion from the family councils. This fact warned Archer to go warily,
but the insinuations about Beaufort made him reckless. He was mindful, however, if not of his own danger, at least of the fact that Mr. Jackson was under his mother's roof, and consequently his guest. Old New York scrupulously observed the etiquette of hospitality, and no discussion with a guest was ever allowed to degenerate into a disagreement. "Shall we go up and join my mother?" he suggested curtly, as Mr. Jackson's last cone of ashes dropped into the brass ashtray at his elbow. On the drive homeward, May remained oddly silent. Through the darkness, he still felt her enveloped in her menacing blush. What its menace meant he could not guess. But he was sufficiently warned by the fact that Madame Olenska's name had evoked it. They went upstairs, and he turned into the library. She usually followed him, but he heard her passing down the passage to her bedroom. "May," he called out impatiently, and she came back, with a slight glance of surprise at his tone. "This lamp is smoking again. I should think the servants might see that it's kept properly trimmed," he grumbled nervously. "I'm so sorry. It shan't happen again," she answered, in the firm bright toneness he had learned from her mother, and it exasperated Archer to feel that she was already beginning to humor him like a younger Mr. Welland. She bent over to lower the wick, and as the light struck upon her white shoulders and the clear curves of her face, he thought, "How young she is! For what endless years this life will have to go on!" He felt, with a kind of horror, his own strong youth and the bounding blood in his veins. "Look here," he said suddenly, "I may have to go to Washington for a few days soon. Next week, perhaps." Her hand remained on the key of the lamp as she turned to him slowly. The heat from its flame had brought back a glow to her face, but it paled as she looked up. "On business?" she asked, in a tone which implied that there could be no other conceivable reason, and that as he had put the question automatically, as if merely to finish his own sentence. "On business, naturally. There's a patent case coming up before the Supreme Court." He gave the name of the inventor, and went on furnishing details with all Lawrence Lefferts' practiced glibness, while she listened attentively, saying at intervals, "Yes, I see. The change will do you good," she said simply, when he had finished. "And you must be sure to go and see Ellen," she added, looking him straight in the eyes with her cloudless smile, and speaking in the tone she might have employed in urging him not to neglect some irksome family duty. It was the only word that passed between them on the subject, but in the code in which they had both been trained it meant, "Of course you understand that I know all that people have been saying about Ellen, and heartily sympathize with my family in their effort to get her to return to her husband. I also know that, for some reason you have not chosen to tell me, you have advised her against this course, which all the older men of the family, as well as our grandmother, agree in approving, and that it is owing to your encouragement that Ellen defies us all, and exposes herself to the kind of criticism of which Mr. Sillerton Jackson probably gave you, this evening, the hint that has made you so." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.